Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I'm Blue.
And we are here to talk about game design. This is the sixth and final episode in our series looking at dominant strategy mitigation. And today we are looking over the last five methods that we discussed and seeing how one game in particular uses those to varying degrees of success. And we're not really using this episode to talk about just that game, but more to frame the discussion overall.
Think of this as a bit of a recap, a bit of a summary episode, some might say.
Yeah, a bit of a recap, a bit of a summary, and a bit of an excuse to talk about this title. Because when we were planning this, we kind of accidentally kept putting this game into the lists and then thought, wait, it has all the things. What if we finish off by talking about it? And now here we are. This six-month joke is finally coming to fruition. We're going to talk about Final Fantasy VIII. It was released in 1999, directed by Yoshinori Kitase, produced by Shinji Hashimoto, and designed by Hiroyuki Ito. Among, of course, a huge team, because it's a big production. And we are very excited to talk about Final Fantasy VIII and its limit breaks.
And we'll be specifically talking about the limit breaks, because they are one of the most powerful mechanics in the game that ends up being quite abusable.
But each one of them, in theory, has a restriction that fairly neatly ties to one of the topics that we've talked about. And with that, let's talk about our first one.
So the first dominant strategy mitigation technique that we talked about way back when in January was repetition mitigation. The concept of this is pretty simple. You can give the player something that's very powerful that they can do over and over and over again in a consistent fashion. They can always choose this option. But if you make it less effective over time as they keep using it, then it won't become something that they only use. That is the only thing that they go for. In Final Fantasy VIII, one of the limit breaks by Irvine is shot. His specific limit break uses ammo that you can craft, buy, find, and produces a powerful effect, you know, with it. Like, you can just shoot someone with normal ammo, which does decent amount of damage, more than his normal attack does, or you can use, at the highest end, pulse ammo to get hypershot, which will probably hit the quad 9 damage limit.
And there are a bunch of, like, specific uses, like there are some that pierce armor, and some that you can fire extremely fast, and normal ammo, Irvine does cool poses between every shot, which is extremely valuable as a gameplay function. Yeah. But all of these cost resources, and that is the limiting factor that stops you just endlessly repeating things. We were looking up a little bit of a guide that suggested that in terms of raw DPS, in ideal situations, fast ammo is the best, but in the few fights it would actually ask you to do optimizing to that point, you'd run out of ammunition before you would finish the fight.
And it's not just about how much he can hold. Sometimes the raw material required to craft the ammo, to obtain the ammo in the first place, is rare. The pulse ammo for the hypershot comes from, I don't remember the specific thing, but an object that is not common in the game. I think in most casual runs, you will have enough I'm going to throw out a rough number, like 10 pulse shots.
I think the amount that you'll just naturally encounter in a playthrough is closer to 12, and 12 is about the requirement you need to make a number of the best weapons in the game.
Right, yeah, and that's the other thing. That ammo is used for things other than just his limit break.
And it comes into a lot of the Final Fantasy VIII economy is that you could have this, or you could have this. And in theory, the game wants these to be genuine choices. Often, what you should do is a lot more clear. It's generally like a much better choice out of the two.
It is worth noting that shot, Irvine's limit break shot, is a really accessible limit break, to the point where speedruns will use this as the primary damage dealing component in their run at the later end.
A lot of games don't necessarily balance things perfectly, especially single player RPGs, and I think the attempt here is that you'll have to keep pumping in money if you want to use this all the time, which should be a good deterrent if money were more of an issue in the game, but it isn't.
And the resource mitigation does exist, because the speedrun does actually mete out how much of each ammo to use up to a particular point, what bosses you're going to expend all of this particular ammo type on. And, you know, there's some routing for that and stuff like that. But in a compressed time frame where time is a resource, availability of resources is a concern, it does matter. You don't just get Irvine and immediately break the game.
And this ties into like some of the other games we talked about, like in Breath of the Wild, we've got item limitations. You can only use items X amount of times before they break. And that means that even if you were to get something powerful ahead of the curve, it only helps you in a limited amount of situations. And you need to like be at least thinking about where are you getting the next thing to use, not unlike the ammo. In Scribblenauts, you had things like, sure, you can use these great solutions, but if you want to get all the rewards, you have to come up with alternate ways to find those solutions. Cosmic Star Heroine, on the other hand, sort of looks at the repetition economy less as an economy of strictly limited resources and more of like a time economy, in that when you do an action, you have to spend another action to enable you to redo things. So you want to optimize and not waste a lot of needless guard turns in order to use your best skills.
At the end of the day, it really is just about encouraging the player to not use the same option over and over and over and over again.
Mm. And all these games, like, the limited economy is very, very different for each of them, but they all, yeah, attempt to mitigate how often you repeat those actions. And I think it's now time to move on to our next topic.
And the next dominant strategy mitigation technique that we talked about was discouraging the safe option, or more specifically, the way we phrased it before was encouraging risky behavior. Oftentimes in games, when you play it safe, you'll be perfectly safe without any problems, but that'll be a lot less fun than pushing the envelope of what the game has given you, pushing your tools a bit, and playing risky, playing with a lot of danger in mind. This is the point in this episode where we kind of get to an awkward spot. This is a bit of a square peg round hole situation where we are forcing Final Fantasy VIII examples not necessarily into where they're the perfect fit. A big part of why they didn't end up in every episode to begin with. But for the purposes of this framing summary narrative, in Final Fantasy VIII, we talk about Rinoa's Limit Break combined. It is a move that has powerful outcomes, but also may not help you whatsoever in the situation you're looking at.
And there's one really interesting nuance to Angel Wing to Combine that I really like, which is that when you add more moves, you're diluting the move pool. So if you have played the game as much as either of us have, there's an interesting choice every time you play through the game, which is, do I stick with two fine to bad options for most of the game so that Invincible Moon and Wishing Star, the two very, very best moves, have a greater chance of coming out? Or do I learn everything and have no clue what will ever happen? Which I think most people tend to just stick with learning a few things if they know that the system functions like that.
With foresight in mind, I think that, yeah, learning less tends to end up being better. Now, there is going to be a bit of crossover here. Some people are definitely going to be thinking to themselves, wait a minute, isn't this just consistency stuff? Yeah, as we said before, there's a bit of square peg round holing going on. But having said that, to counter that, Invincible Moon is not always a good option, and there is a risk associated with this. It is 100% a move that is worth learning for Combine, in my opinion, because the effect is really, really strong.
And the effect is invincible.
Which is not a common state in most Final Fantasies, I would say, as well.
Yeah, it's pretty rare. And Invincible works in a lot of very bizarre ways in Final Fantasy VIII, because it locks you into whatever conditions you might already have, be they good or bad. So if you're slowed and cast Invincible, you cannot be unslowed during that time.
Nothing affects you. Nothing can remove the invincibility even to change that state.
Which is very interesting, although the amount of times that it's bad is pretty rare. But there are points when you definitely would have rather have just like, I just want a good damage move to finish things off.
Yeah. So that's our attempt at like kind of justifying why it's here. Now, in more practical examples, such as the ones that we spoke about in the episode itself, you have the action style. We want you to go in and play close to the enemy and play in dangerous situations, such as in Bloodborne and Bayonetta.
So Bloodborne gives you rewards for being risky by giving you back what you've lost, and Bayonetta, rather than acting once you've lost something, is just giving you a really strong offensive boon, or in a few boss fights, literally letting you hurt them, which is not super exciting. FF13 gives you like ridiculous rewards if you keep up a little bit of something. FF8, I mean, is in the list, and we probably shouldn't have left it in the list given we're making this episode now, so that was just a real risk that we took, that whether that's paying off is the listener's choice.
But if whoever's listening does remember how we spoke about Final Fantasy VIII in the original list, in the original episode, we spoke more about the crisis system, which leads to all of these limit breaks. But basically, having characters in a more dire strait, with lower health, with more statuses on them, gives you access to all of these powerful offensive options that we're talking about here.
And generally, the greater the crisis you're in, the more powerful these techniques are. So for Irvine, which we mentioned first, the more crisis you're in gives you a greater length of time to shoot and use his ability. Does crisis affect Renoa's limit break much? That would have been great research to do in advance.
Not as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I think it ups the rates on a few of the rarer ones, but I'm not going to say that confidently. I'm going to say that unconfidently because I'm not entirely sure.
Very unsure about any of that statement. So, grain of salt. There is another aspect to Renoa's limit break, which is also risky in another way, which is her second limit break in the game, Angel Wing. What Angel Wing does is it puts her in quote-unquote magic berserk state, where her ATB fills up, and then without control, she casts a magic spell that does about 5 times more damage than it should.
Which allows, if you build really specifically for it, lots of really cool situations. But mostly, it's fairly risky in that you're losing a potential person to heal, and Renoa is probably your better healer, given she has high magic stat, and you don't know what she's going to cast. And if you've built her up as a typical character, a lot of those spells aren't going to be doing a lot. You're going to be doing something, but there'll be other ways to easily out-damage them.
The variance is also dangerous because if you don't control her stock of magic, which, first of all, the spells that are cast out of Angel Wing depends on what magic she has on her. That is not specifically made clear to the player, as far as I'm aware.
Like a lot of things, Nate, if you go into the tutorial information section, the game has a lot of information to tell you about everything, but it would never, like, direct you to go there in these sort of cases.
So it is completely understandable for someone to think, she just casts random magic. And that's dangerous because if a boss has not even a resistance, but an absorption for some magic, you could end up healing them.
And it's also not that she casts random magic, it's that she casts random offensive magic.
Correct.
Because she will never heal your party, she will never buff anyone, which in Final Fantasy VIII, buffing people is not that important, but that's besides the point. Yeah, she got 2 limit breaks. And if you dedicate Renoa and you make a fairly risky build that is only useful when you have Angel Wing on and is terrible for general play, you know, you're taking that risk, making her bad a lot of the time so that this 10% of the time she can be exceptionally amazing through basically having only a very specific attack spell on that has multiple hits, meaning you can break the damage limit very easily and hit for lots of damage pretty consistently at minimal cost. Except for the fact that if you're not an Angel Wing, she's not doing much at all.
And that's kind of really about it for encouraging risky behavior as a dominant strategy. It's a way for developers and the game itself to just say, play in a more interesting way, you'll have more fun that way.
And next up is perhaps the squarest peg and the roundest hole. Next up, we have Quistis from Final Fantasy VIII. Her ability is blue magic, which she learns by using up items. Not too unlike Irvine, her ability is sort of tied into the economy of the game. Often the items she could learn limit breaks from could be used to make other powerful things, although most of them can be gotten multiple copies of. So there's not much in the way of loss. It's more of a, do I get this now or later? So with Quistis, you often are getting lots of new abilities for your limit break and experimenting with what is best, what is good, what is useful here, what is not useful here. At least that's the idea of it. A lot of the abilities are either very situational or very clearly better than others. And a lot of the clearly best ones are not good in the difficult encounters such as bosses. So it's not the greatest success, which is partially why it's the squarest peg in the roundest hole. But it's there, so you're constantly getting new abilities with which to tinker with. And that is something we didn't really discuss much in the new content episode outside of Street Fighter, which did it through patches and giving characters new abilities, which change up dynamics of matches, but they were new patches, not just new abilities acquired through the general course of play, which is an interesting distinction, depending on how much you want to make that distinction, I guess.
Yeah, there is something to be said about this character gains, even not even power. Sometimes this character or the game is just giving you more options, more... what's the term I'm looking for here? Swiss Army knife like more tools in your toolkit. And sometimes that alone is enough to encourage differences in behavior and encourage you away from just using the same thing over and over again. If you can make these new options look appealing, sound appealing, feel satisfying.
And that's generally how Final Fantasy VIII has structured their blue mages. They're usually, in a per spell basis, the worst spellcaster. But when you look at them in their variety, then the amount of different things you can do and the amount of possibilities they offer, that's when they become more interesting. And that's kind of where Quistus is supposed to fall in the game, in that her limit break could be anything you need it to be at the time.
So in contrast, once you learn a blue magic, you have it forever. Because the game doesn't use MP as a resource, if you're in limit break, you can pick any spell that she has available via her blue magic.
Ish. There are multiple boxes of spells, I guess you could say. So you won't always have all of them. You'll have like one third of them, or one set of the spells or so.
Right. Still quite consistent though.
Yeah, it's not quite consistent. Like, you know, generally you're going to get like some of your best options in every box.
Does that mean if you learn few enough spells, you can always have Shockwave Pulsar?
No, because they're basically separate windows that are occupied by a collection of spells. So like, if you get window A, you have these spells. If you have window B, you have these spells.
But you start the game with one blue magic, correct?
And that one appears in every box. Like, there is cross-pollination between the boxes.
But what I mean is, what if you learn nothing until Shockwave Pulsar? You could get a 50-50?
Maybe? I don't remember how many boxes it is either, but there are ways to gimmick it, because I think it might be 3 or 4 boxes in total if you learn everything, but you probably don't. I should have done more information research before this.
It's fine. It's fine. This is definitely one of the less utilized limit breaks in the game.
It really is, which is a shame, because it's like a lot of things with 8, I guess. It's potentially very, very interesting, but the game never really asks you to engage with a lot of the things that it offers you. Whereas a lot of the new content sort of things, they're generally dealing with things that players have maybe engaged too much with, is a lot of the cases for them.
So, for example, you know, in Hearthstone, in card games, new content is a way to freshen up a format, because give enough players enough time with a set of cards, things will go stale. And one of the only ways to reinvigorate the format is to add new content to it, or potentially remove old cards from it to change the answers that are available. You already brought up Street Fighter V, and that does a very similar thing, but in a very concentrated burst of every character's changing, you need to learn all of these new situations all over again.
Very much information overload. If we were going to cheat and not have used a character from Final Fantasy VIII for this example, probably Gal from Final Fantasy VI might have been a better candidate, because he has such a breadth of options that the amount of time it takes to like learn everything is more or less how you prevent people from finding a dominant strategy with him. You just ask them to deal with such a large amount of possibility space. And I guess with that, we should move on to our next topic. The next topic we talked about was consistency. And there's some confusion between the differences of consistency mitigation and repetition mitigation, because ultimately, anything that mitigates consistency will mitigate repetition, but consistency mitigation is more about limiting the access to the option to start with, I guess you could say.
Absolutely. In repetition mitigation, when you use it, the player can still do it even if it gets bad.
Cosmic Star Heroine is repetition mitigation, not consistency, because you use it, then you use an ability, you use Guard to give you back the ability, you use it again. You can still repeat, but it's asking you to repeat less frequently through its other mechanics that support that system. Whereas consistency is more like in a roguelike or a card game, where it's like, do you have the option or not? And that is the question. So the characters that represent this, primarily, we want to look at Selphie. Selphie has an ability called Slots, which is you basically open it up and it gives you magic and outcome of usages. So it might be Blizzard 4 times, Cure 5 times, and so on and so forth. You can either cast the spell it offers you or click next, and you get another chance at seeing what magical outcomes you have. It's a very simple move. It plays in really nicely with ATB systems in Final Fantasy, which not a lot of mechanics actually do, which is kind of interesting in itself. You know, you can burn time by flicking through the options. Selphie has some of with the best magic unique to her in the game. Even magic that can literally kill any boss in a single shot, at the expense of having to constantly re-roll to get to it.
It is extremely rare to begin with, and then once you see it for the first time and use it, then it becomes slightly more common, but still rare.
And there are a few, like, time gates in the game, more or less, as to when she can learn it, I believe, right? Like, she doesn't have all of the things potentially in her list right away. You have to sort of earn them over the course of the game, although the game never really directly tells you how you've earned them.
No, there isn't, like, a pop-up at some point that says, Selphie can now end any fight.
Yeah. But Selphie's ability set gives you access to a lot of very powerful moments before you get things like triple and double, which are how you often get to cast multiple rounds of magic in a turn. So you've got this, like, she's good, but will I get a good outcome from her in the time I would need to take? In the original PlayStation 1 version, you could cheat this really easily by opening the PlayStation lid, and the game wouldn't load any more actions into RAM for any other characters, so you could scroll endlessly through it, because the algorithm for her magic is in the RAM already. But that's not really a design choice, that's just a tactical abuse.
Yeah, that's effectively a glitch.
It's effectively a glitch. It's interesting though.
Yes.
It's kind of interesting how in 8, like, a lot of the things are sort of countered by some method within the game itself. Anyway, so that's Selphie, and she's like the primary intended example of consistency. Another great example is Zell, who is going to crop up in the last section too, which is, in theory, his limit break is supposed to work in you input a fighting game style command, and that opens up a new window, which gives you a list of options and a time limit. You put another command, giving you another list of options. In theory, you're not supposed to necessarily know what the full thread is going to be, and you're going to have to make responses to it. And you don't know where you're going to start either, so you can't just, in theory, plan out a complete combo to a good ender. You have to see what you get and adapt to it.
In theory. That's where this kind of all breaks down, because all of that is in theory.
And we're going to get to that in theory in meeting the challenge. But for now, consistency. So Selphie's slot mechanic is not too unlike a very limited idea of drafting in Magic or any of the other, like, primarily random single-use effects that we talked about in things. In fact, it's quite a lot like item characters in fighting games, most of all, which was our last discussion point in consistency.
You get an effect and is random. I think the thing about Selphie is that it's always beneficial.
Yeah, there's never a case of like, oh, I accidentally picked fire 5 times, and so 2 of those times on my party. It's always used as you would expect it to be used. There are a few, like, I cast Cure 5 times, but it casts 3 times on Squall and twice on Zell and none on Selphie. So yeah, I can be dumb, but it's never bad.
Yeah. Heal spells, buff spells go on your party. Offensive spells go on the enemy. It doesn't account for every situation. It doesn't account for, as you said, someone that's low on health. Or it doesn't account for a zombie status effect, I think. It doesn't account for. But effectively, that's the dichotomy that it goes for. And that doesn't have to be the case. Like, you can mitigate consistency by putting in bad options for, or even neutral options that just make the game or game state more interesting into whatever the player is looking to do.
And a lot of that, like, more horizontal options, I guess you might say, things like shearing, where a lot of things are not necessarily better than each other, but they just preventing different interesting options that you have, and you decide, is this the thing I want to use or not? Selphie's mechanic's a little different in that you have the choice to just reroll, and the cost of that is pretty small. It is time, but AIDS battles are not exactly lightning speed, so you could easily roll 10 or 15 times fairly quickly, assuming you've got pretty decent reading ability.
Without wasting any other character's ability to act in that moment. In fact, if you really wanted to and you were really looking for a spell, if you don't mind Selphie sitting out, you can roll a few times, cancel out of her menu, switch characters that you're controlling, and then come back to her.
So I guess here, like, Selphie is as consistent as you want to be, assuming you're willing to spend time, which is kind of an interesting nuance compared to the other games, where, like, in games like Magic, you want to ultimately have a very consistent deck, and you can build to that by sacrificing diversity. And here, it's like, you can always cast what you want with Selphie, in theory, if you're willing to just burn enough time to do so. There's a trade-off between these things.
Yeah, I think that kind of covers everything we had to say about consistency mitigation, which leaves us with the final topic.
The best topic. The topic we talked about last month was meeting the challenge, and to represent this, we're going to talk in more depth about Zell's Jewel command, which is pretty simple. You get presented with a small text box that has a list of several options that you then go on to pick the next option. You pick an option from, input it, then take a new command window, do that option, all under a fairly limited timer. So the idea is a combination of how many things can you get out in the timer, alongside can you do a path of actions that will lead you to a very powerful ender, and balancing out trying to push both those things. That's the design goal of this move, at the very least, regardless of any abuses, which we are going to talk about.
And then before we get into those abuses, the concept for meeting the challenge is literally just acknowledging that the player will have very powerful options at their disposal. They will have, in the case of duel, powerful enders that they can get to. And actually, no, that's not quite right.
With Jewel, they'll have a lot of things they can do. Like, if you can do Jewel very well, you can get ridiculous damage output that is far greater than anyone else.
Yeah.
And it's a case of how well can you see the text boxes, recognize what they're presenting you, and making a choice about them. That is where the main challenge comes in. How much can you do in a limited amount of time?
Definitely. Pattern recognition, text recognition.
And even a small bit of, like, risk-reward, because whether you want to, like, go, oh, I see I could do Burning Heaven right now, but I've got 3 seconds left. Maybe I could do 5 extra moves and get to a different ender, or get to the same ender again and have gotten more out of my time here. So there's a lot of, like, how far do you want to push yourself with this move is, like, why it fits, in extremely loose definitions, meeting the challenge.
Yeah. Now, why is it broken?
Why is it broken? Well, it's supposed to be not 100% predictable. Like, it's supposed to be consistent. Oh, if I do this and this and this and this, I should generally get to this move. So there's a set progression that's sort of there, but it's not supposed to be 100% the same every time, so that you've got some things to figure out. However, there are a few pairs of moves that will always present an options box that contains another move, the other move, which will always bring you back to the first move. The most famous of these is Booyah and Heal Drop, which will always lead into each other and can lead you to not need to read the text boxes anymore. You're just, the moment you see the text box appear, you input the command because you know it's going to be there.
This kind of breaks the system a bit.
Yeah, a lot of players call this Armageddon Fist, even though it's not necessarily the most fisty thing that Zell can do.
Yeah, Booyah's a headbutt.
Yep. And then it's a kick, it's a heel drop, because that's what it says.
So the Armageddon
Fist... So the thematics of the fan name is not great.
No. And Armageddon Fist is the highest damage limit break you can do.
Yeah, more or less. It's the most damage that you can reasonably do in the game.
Outside of the end, which doesn't deal damage, it just ends the fight.
Although, actually, you mentioned Irvine in the first section in Speedrunners. Does he... I assume he out-damages Zell, potentially?
No, he does not.
No, he does not. Okay.
So Speedrunners use it because it's easier to get Irvine to that damage level early. One of the things that you need to do with Zell to make his damage worthwhile is get good magic on his strength.
Yeah, so using junction abilities to increase strength to the maximum. And should you do that, he's a monster. But interestingly, like, there are parts of the game that withstand this sort of thing. So Final Fantasy VIII has level scaling in it. So if you're highly leveled up, a lot of bosses might actually have ridiculous HP to withstand some of this. When I was fighting the end boss and used this technique, I had to do it many times to actually fully kill all of Ultimecia.
Yeah, not to mention Ultimecia has many forms, so you... Once a form is depleted of health, she doesn't take more damage in the next one.
And then, of course, there's the Amigo weapon, the super boss, which this feels necessary almost to get through him.
Almost, yeah. Omega weapon's maximum health caps out at roughly 1.5 million. And when each individual hit of yours tends to be capped out at 9999, that's a lot of punching and kicking to do.
It really is. Because I think, like, getting, you know, 100, 200,000 damage out of this is on the higher end for a lot of players. So a lot of other games that let you do ridiculous things and still had challenges for you, with like Bravely Default also having some super bosses that really put you to task. Slay the Spire even went so far as like almost be like, we know that you've got some broken stuff, but sometimes we're going to break that broken stuff.
Warning Forever effectively cheats and keeps making things harder until you lose.
Yeah, so I guess if 8 tried something very similar, that it'd be like, ah, every time you do a type of damage, they would gain some resistance to it. I mean, fighting games kind of do that, actually, now that I think about it. Damage scaling over the length of a combo. If 8 had something like that, this would not be an issue at all.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and... Smash Brothers and Red Alert 3 don't really fit into the exact paradigm we're thinking of here with Zelda, but they do both deal with meeting the challenge, of course.
In their own ways.
In their own different ways.
And that's basically it. Yeah. Those are some of the techniques, some of the more common ones at least, for how to mitigate dominant strategies and dominant strategies just taking over a game.
Hmm. And with that, we'll lead into our wrap up and ending notes. And with that, we've come to the end of a long, long, long series of looking at dominant strategies. It's been a fairly long ride, 6-ish months now, starting at kind of a joke and ending at a punchline of that joke, I guess. But I think that dominant strategies are a really interesting issue for games in general. And I think spending some time really thinking about it in different contexts has been a lot of fun, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I don't think we perfectly hit the nail on the head every time.
Yeah, some of these topics, I think in hindsight, were perhaps a little forced, maybe a good idea a little bit, but I think we got good discussions out of all these episodes.
I think so.
Maybe some of them were not quite as solid, but I hope that it really has encouraged our listeners to think about dominant strategies in a different way from just, this is OP, to players just sticking with the same options because they stick with them more than they explore. And that there are a lot of ways in which you can solve this that isn't just pure power level changing.
It's about, I think that one of the things is just variety. If a player wants to stick to something after they've given stuff a shot, that's fine. I also think that in the grand scheme of things, while we may not have hit the ball out of the park for every episode, I'm really glad for some of the games that we were able to look at for this.
Yes, there are a number of just like, I'm so glad we can finally talk about this things. Like the consistency episode is one of my favorites in terms of game selection, because we got to talk about Shirin, Lost Dimension, and a Saga game. Maybe not the Saga game I wished we could talk about, but a Saga game.
Saga Unlimited is a special, special experience.
Yeah, and we got to bring up a lot of, and you got to bring up Battle Moon Wars.
I love that game. This is very true. I love that game.
I am legitimately surprised ever got to come into a Platforms and Pitfalls episode. Not for a quality reason, just like, I had never thought it would come up.
I'm really glad we got to play Cosmic Star Heroine.
Oh, yes, of course. That was something that had been on a back burner for a long time, but it just fits so nicely.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It's a really smart game. It's really cool. Does a lot of things very well. So, while overall questionable in terms of how cohesive we were or even consistent in what we were saying, I think that we at least certainly got a good selection of games out there to think about, to talk about. I, you know, wholeheartedly still say, if you're interested in design, check out Saga Unlimited. Such a weird ride.
Yeah. And that can be said for so many of the things we talked about, really. I'm really glad that we get to do these experiments still. We are happy to keep trying these things, because especially since our show is so rigidly structured around a set idea or form, that it can be easy to fall into a rut with that. And although for the next 6 months, we hope to maybe more stick to the actual format and have very distinct separate episodes for a while, which we haven't had for a long time now.
We have been a bit inconsistent, and not because of, you know, any want or desire, but more because of real life circumstances.
Yeah, we wanted to experiment and we have. And I guess on that, since we're talking about all this self-reflection, this month you're actually going to get 2 episodes. So this is going to come out on June 15th-ish, plus or minus a day, depending on time zones and when I get it out. Then on the Saturday after that, on the 20th of June, we are going to record an addendum episode where we look back not just at this last set of episodes, but also a bunch of last years as well. We're going to cover just things that we think we missed in those episodes that we wish we could talk more about, things about the show that have cropped up, and answer any questions you have. We already have one or two from a few people, but we'd like to have a bit more interaction with you guys.
If you like something we're doing, if you don't like something we're doing, let us know.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about a few like concerns we have about the show that we want your feedback on, like how we credit certain groups and things. But with all that, I'm glad that you've stuck with us for this mini series.
And if you jumped in here, if this is somehow the first episode of ours you've listened to, we did talk about all of the topics today in an episode each of about an hour each.
Yes, this is very much the summary of things. I might go back and put an episode warning at the start saying, if this is your first episode, don't.
If you listen through, I think it's not that bad.
Maybe I'll put a textual warning then, but no one will read because in the show notes.
Yep.
On that note, if you want to engage with us, you can find all our information in the show notes that I just accused no one of reading. And with that, let me give you the hints for the July episode. The games that we're going to talk about are Sonic Advance 3, The Messenger, and Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Plus, of course, two more games. If you can guess what the topic will be, we'll be very impressed. And with that,
thank you for listening.
I just have a short little end note to the episode. Since we're going to be doing an addendum next week, and to be released at the end of the month, I have added a feature to the website. We now can accept voicemails, which one of our listeners has already sent as a bit of a test. So, to use our voicemail, go to idriseffect.net/contact, and there you can send us an email through a form or a voicemail, and we'd love to have your voicemails in on the next episode. And with that, thank you for listening.